okay. Okay, so as I said, I want to wrap things up in regards to the issue of pluralism as Diana Eck understands pluralism. So that's the reason I asked you to watch the last video last night. And at some point, what I'll do is I'm going to replay her summary at the end of this. But there are a few things in the video that I'd like to mention, and I actually want to expand on in a way in which she really hasn't expanded on. She does tell the story about this Boston Brahmin, as she says. Boston Brahmins means like the upper crust. The term derives from the Brahmins in India were the priests, and so the Boston Brahmins were the upper crust, the wealthy society leaders in Boston in the 19th century. So that's what they were called.
B-R-A-H-M-A-N.
I'm not sure how it's spelled in Boston, actually. Well, because it's derived from the Sanskrit. So I don't know how they actually spelled it, but anyhow, Boston Brahmins.
It means
the upper crust of society. Oh. Definitely not mountain men. It's like the wealthy establishment in Boston was called the Brahmins. They kind of ran the culture and they ran the city until the Irish took over, that is. But that's a different story. Okay, anyway. So she talks about this man by the name of Bigelow, who went to Japan in 1882, and for the rest of his life, he tried to figure out how to combine his personal sense of Buddhism with his social environment in which he was an Episcopalian, upper-class Episcopalian. He tried to live out his life in Boston, bringing these things together, and he had a pretty hard time of it. So then Eck goes on to talk about these kind of braided religious traditions, is the term that she uses, for people whose religiosity is bringing together elements of different traditions. And so she uses the example of braiding, like, you know, bring together parts of your hair in certain ways. She also uses the term syncretism, which you may not have come across. So syncretism is a way of describing historic processes that we've seen with religions where they come together and something new emerges from the religions coming together. So there are a lot of examples in India of religious syncretism where, for example, you have Muslims and Hindus in India who are trying to work out their relationship and something new emerges. And some people will call Sikhism a syncretistic result of that. I'm not sure if that's correct or not, but there are examples of this sort of thing. And there are particular examples of individuals who are very syncretic, or syncretistic is probably the right word, in their views. Now, next week, we will be reading the Christian theology of a man by the name of Hick, who is a very prominent theologian who is interested in issues of pluralism from a Christian point of view. But then we'll go very rapidly into talking about someone called Ramakrishna, who was an Indian saint, I think is fair, call him a saint, who lived from 1836 to 1886 in the Calcutta area. And we'll be looking at his experience, what he has to say about religions and religious syncretism. Because his views, and this is a very important person in India, by the way, his views are very different from Eck's views, and very different from the views of the Dalai Lama, who we'll be reading about after that. And his views have actually worked their way into, surprisingly, into modern society in ways that are unexpected, and so we'll talk about that. Now, Eck is clearly not a fan of syncretism. She's a fan of the idea that multiple religions need to be, you can't really say religions, let me say the followers of multiple religions need to be in active dialogic communication with each other, need to maintain their own religious tradition in that dialogue and need to understand that they're not going to reach agreement about a whole lot of stuff. Then, in essence, they're going to agree to disagree. Like my wife and I frequently agree to disagree. Well, no, that's not actually true. My wife and I frequently disagree, and we know we're going to disagree, and it's an achievement when we agree to disagree, that your view and my view are different. We're not going to try and convince each other of anything. But that's going to be okay until we have to make some sort of decision where there's only one possibility based upon one view, and then things fall apart again. But that's not really the issue in religions, because for the most part with religions, the things that people will agree or disagree upon tend to be personal and tend to be internal. So if we agree to disagree about the fate of our souls after we die, it may not be a matter of anybody's concern, because when you die, what's going to happen to your soul is your problem. It's not my problem, right? And when I die, what happens to my soul is my problem. It's not your problem. So we can believe that very different things are going to happen, and it doesn't make any difference unless there's some sort of shared environment that we have to negotiate that's going to impact all of that. So, for example, if we were to believe that for some reason the only way I'm going to achieve salvation is to cut down all the trees within 100 miles, and you believe the only way you're going to achieve salvation is to have as many trees as possible within 100 miles, I know this is ridiculous, then we're going to have a problem. Fortunately, you don't see too much of that stuff in religions, so it doesn't become an issue. But I'm not going to actually, as it turns out, play the Eck video because we're sort of short on time. But one of the points that Eck makes, as she sums up in her video, and I'll tell you where this is, it's in the last recording, which is called The Pluralism Within, and it starts at 55 minutes and 45 seconds, just in case you want to look it up. She does a summary at the end, and basically what she's saying is, why is it important to study religion? And that's really kind of the point that I'm coming to in this talk. The reason it's important to study religion is because we really need to know who these people are that we are in relationship with, either in a diverse society or a pluralistic society. We need to know their religious values. We need to know about them. We need to know what they care about in order to make this society function. Not true in Le Grand, definitely true in Boston, definitely true in Newark, definitely true in Los Angeles, for example. I mean, many of the big cities. And she does have an entire lecture on the urban situation and why this is so important in the urban world, not so important in the rural world. Okay, so that's the argument for why we need to study religion, and that's essentially the argument for why I'm doing what I'm doing in this course, which is not just what is religion, but what is religion as understood by people of different faiths, because it turns out to be very different. And what do we do about that? Because then what do we even mean by religion? Now, she does talk about these braided traditions, or these braided experiences, I think is better to say, because what she's talking about is individuals who practice more than one tradition. And she seems to sort of share a bit of ambivalence about this. I mean, again, in this particular recording, she talks about someone called Clooney, who is, I think she said, was a Jesuit. But he's also
George Clooney?
No, not George Clooney. I think he practices a different kind of religion than the Clooney that's talked about here. And I think he was a Jesuit priest. Did you recall that? Was he a Jesuit priest? And he was practicing another religion, which I believe was in the Hindu tradition rather than Buddhist. But it might have been Buddhist. It was one or the other. Was it Buddhist? Do you recall?
I thought it was Buddhism.
It could be. And it would make more sense. So anyhow, he brings both of these traditions into his own practice. So this would be an example of syncretism in that he's bringing these two things together. And she says there's a virtue to this. Now, a lot of people would say that there's no virtue to that at all, because what's going to be lost is your own particular faith. She says there's a virtue to it, but she doesn't go into great detail about what that virtue might be. So I'm going to, And I'm going to give you an example of what that virtue might be. And I'm going to draw as a metaphor our own experience of vision and our own experience of hearing. So, do you know, anybody know what parallax vision is? Do you know that term? Have you run across that in class someplace? Parallax vision, have you?
We talked about it once in psychology, if I remember.
Okay. All right. I'll go into more detail about it, be very specific about it. Most animals, like us, have two eyes. I mean, spiders have 8 or 10 or God, I don't know what. But certainly mammals have two eyes. And they're separated by a little bit of space. Now, if I hold my finger up and you look at my finger, if you close your right eye and look at my finger with your left eye, and then close your left eye and look at my finger with your right eye, or put your hand in front or whatever the case may be, you see my finger moving around? The reason my finger moves around is, obviously my finger isn't moving, but from the point of view of your two eyes, there's a little bit different space, and so you're looking at that finger from a different angle. And what you see when you look at the finger and what's behind the finger will changes, because your right eye is seeing what's behind the finger from a different angle than your left eye. But when you have both eyes open, you don't really see that. You only see the one image. And that's because what your brain does is it takes that discordant, those two discordant views, and it merges them so that you don't notice it. Your brain is very good at doing that. But your brain does something else. When it merges those two images, it does it in such a way that it actually creates something new in your perception, which we call depth. If you only have one eye, you have no depth perception. In order to have depth perception, you have to have two eyes. And if you don't think I'm right, you can perform an experiment in which you'll really get this, which is walk around with one hand over a patch over one of your eyes and try and do things around the house. And you'll discover you start bumping into stuff. You miss steps and so on and so forth. Because at first, your mind will know where things are from the point of view of the depth or the distance away from you because you remember that. But pretty soon, you'll only be dependent upon the actual perception of what's happening there, and you won't be able to have perception of depth because that requires two eyes. So the two eyes that create that new kind of information by virtue of there being two eyes rather than one, that's called parallax vision. The same thing actually functions for sound, as it turns out. So if there's a sound over to the right of the room, I recognize that that sound is to the right of the room rather than to the left of the room. But how does that happen? Well, the sound waves are coming from the right rather than from the left. But how do I know the sound waves are coming from the right rather than the left? Because I can't see them. Well, what happens is the sound waves that are coming from the right strike my right eardrum or my right ear before the left. And your brain is so attuned to this that your brain recognizes that the sound first appeared or was cognized on the right before it was cognized on the left. Now, you don't notice that consciously, but unconsciously, if you will, your brain or your cognitive mechanism knows that. And so you interpret the fact that sound, although you don't know you're doing this, you interpret the fact that sound is on the right side before the left side of your head as the sound is coming from the right. And of course, things can get confusing then when there are echoes and so on and so forth. And then we do get disoriented when that stuff happens. It's the same as parallax vision. So we have the two ears, and we get a sense of sound being localized in space because of that. And in fact, you put those two things together, and we get a very good sense of what's going on around us in the three dimensions of space, because we see depth, and we hear the space around us because of where sound originates. This is all because we have two eyes and two ears. If you use that as a metaphor, and you're trying to understand something about that which is not obvious, like most of the things that religions talk about, God, soul, life after death, so on and so forth, if you only have one vision of things, say the Christian vision, is that limiting or not? Now, some people will say, no, of course it's not limiting because it's the truth and there's only one truth. These would be people who we would call conservatives, or at the far end, we might call them fundamentalists or absolutists. But people who have a more liberal view or a more relativistic view would say, look, if I study or practice Buddhism and Christianity, and I view reality from the Buddhist point of view, or I view God from the Buddhist point of view and the Christian point of view, I'm going to see some new stuff that I wouldn't have seen from only one point of view. Like the two eyes that create depth, or the two ears that create the sense of space around one. Learning about multiple religions will potentially teach people something new that they wouldn't learn any other way. And even at a deeper level, practicing two religions might do that if there were a way to practice the two religions. Now, of course, this also creates certain problems. So, questions?
Well, that just kind of made me remember something that I did. Because I work at Walmart, so I see a few different kinds of people. And one of the cashiers that I used to work with was Jewish. She doesn't work there anymore. And then the doctor I work with, he was Mormon. And then I was really curious, so they both talked to me about the basics of their religions and what they were thinking, and it made a lot of sense, but it kind of agreed with some of the things I already thought. So I just kind of like, oh, that's really cool.
And what would happen if in that conversation somebody said something that you didn't know, didn't agree with, but you had to think about and began to wonder about and might stimulate you to think about, could that be true or not?
There were a couple things, but I just couldn't quite grasp it. I mean, I didn't think that they were completely wrong or anything, but like, there's a lot of things that you say that I agree with, but then others I don't quite, I can't grasp it.
Right. So
yeah.
So let me give an example of why this might be valuable. Christians, on the whole, believe in heaven and hell. That's basically Christian doctrine. Okay. As it turns out, Buddhists also believe in heaven and hell. Okay. So that's not really well known, I don't think, but Buddhists do believe in heaven and hell. But there's a difference. Now, Christians believe that when you die, you go to heaven or you go to hell, and you stay there. That's it. Forever. Buddhists don't believe anything is forever. They believe that everything is always changing. So if you go to heaven, you only stay there for a while, and then you get reborn. They believe in reincarnation. So that doesn't sound so good. If you go to heaven, you want to be able to stay there. But on the other hand, if you go to hell, you want to get out. And from the Buddhist point of view, you will get out, although from the Christian point of view, you won't. Now, we could, if we were sort of approaching this in a very simple way, we could say, well, one of them's got to be right and the other one's got to be wrong. It can't be both ways. I mean, it's either forever or it's not forever. It can't be both. I mean, that's logically inconsistent. Or we could say, wait a minute. For thousands of years, there have been all these Buddhists in this part of the world. And for thousands of years, there have been all these Christians in this other part of the world. Does it make any sense that one part of the world was right and the other part of the world was wrong? How do we interpret this? How do we think about this? Could they both be right? Maybe they're both wrong. There isn't any heaven. There isn't any hell. I'm not proposing an answer to this, but what I'm saying is that the actual dialogic encounter between these two points of view is like the parallax vision that forces you to look at things and wonder about stuff you might never have wondered about. Like, well, where did this idea come from, if it's an idea? Or did Jesus ever say that when you go to heaven, you stay there all the time? We know that Buddha said if you go to heaven, you don't stay there all the time. But did Jesus ever say that you do? Or did the church say that? Then that leads to questions about the difference between the church and the founder. And if you ask those questions about Christianity, then you might actually start asking those questions about Buddhism too. Because if there's a difference between, I'll get you in just a second, if there's a difference between the church and the founder, would that only be the case in the Christian world? Wouldn't it be the case in the rest of the world? Maybe this is a human phenomenon or a historical phenomenon. So now all kinds of questions start coming up because you have these two points of view that would otherwise have not come up. And maybe answers also come out. And maybe you also learn about how do religions function. You know, we say that fish don't know anything about water because they're in it all the time. They don't even know what it is. I mean, once they're on a hook and they're out of the water, then they know what water is. But until that happens, or unless they jump up in the air to grab a bug, you know, I mean, until that happens, they don't know what water is because they're in it all the time. So in the Middle Ages, in the Christian world, where there was nothing around but Christians, and there were parts of the world that were like that, people didn't know anything else. It was like, what was Christianity to them? They couldn't step outside of themselves and look at it because they had no place to step to look at it because there was no alternative. And since there was no alternative, there was no somewhat abstract or independent awareness or consciousness of the phenomenon. So it requires multiplicity of experience of phenomena to be able to understand things. You have to be able to compare and contrast. In fact, if you think about it, that's a lot of what happens in the scientific approach to understanding things. You set up an experiment, and what does the experiment do? You set up different conditions, alternatives, and you look at those alternatives. And based upon those alternatives, you derive some information. If you can only do one thing one way, you don't really have an experiment anymore. You have a test, maybe, but you could hardly call it an experiment, and you can't build a science on it. Okay? So this makes sense, I think. It's pretty straightforward. So people who are braided in their religious practice are people who are working out the problems that are associated with these multiple points of view. Scholars who look at different religions are potentially working out the problem from the abstract point of view. And citizens who are doing that are working out the problem from the civic point of view. Okay, so what was your question, Alex?
Oh, I was just going to say that you said that one thing I do know about the Bible is my favorite scripture is John 2:16. At the end it says, those who believe in him shall not perish but enjoy everlasting life. That can be described, everlasting can be like kind of like a ripple where go to heaven, go back down to earth, go to heaven. That's everlasting life. You have many lives.
That could be interpreted that. I'd never thought about that. You're right. It could
when
be interpreted.
You told me about that with the Buddhist. I was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, but I never thought about that particular scriptural quotation as interpretable in that way, because most people, when they read it, they say, oh, you go to heaven and you're there forever.
Yeah.
But
that's not really alive because you're
in
dead.
Heaven. Yeah, right. So what is everlasting life? That is very interesting. I had not thought about that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So I might use that in a future class. Do you mind? I won't attribute it to you, but I might use it. Okay. So the last thing I want to say then is when Eck talks about this person Bigelow had already discerned in the 1880s or 1890s in Japan that there was something about the relationship of Buddhism and psychology that would be important, but he didn't exactly understand why. I think, and there's a reason why Eck brings this up, I think that we can expand on that idea. There's something about the relationship of religion and psychology that's important. And that's why I want to investigate that in this class, and it's going to be a major theme. And the reason for that is that if you look for the common denominator in all religions, what is the common denominator? All religions are practiced by human beings who have minds and bodies. So if we know something about the way human beings' minds and bodies connect with their religiosity, we may find, and I'm going to say we may find a commonality that underlies all different religions, which creates a new level of understanding and comprehension, which otherwise doesn't exist. Now, if we go back again to Eck, one of the dichotomies that is implicit in what she's talking about is the dichotomy of what I've called esoteric and exoteric religion. Exo means outside of, means religion that's practiced outside of us, common social religion. It's like you go down to church down to the road on Sunday, and that's the religion you practice. Esoteric religion is what she calls the inner dimension of religion, or more typically what's called mysticism, which is the seeking of personal religious experience. I don't want to just worship God. I want to have a personal relationship with God. And I don't want to just have a personal relationship with God. I want to know that when I pray to God, that some communication is happening. And some people would say, although it might get him in trouble in some places, when I pray to God, I want to hear what he has to say to me. Okay. Now, evangelicals understand that in the Christian tradition, that there's a two-way communication. What that communication is going to be like is understood differently. For many people, if they said, God was talking to me last night when I was praying to him, and you said, what does that mean? And they said, oh, well, you know, I just knew that my prayer was answered and that everything was going to be okay with my wife who was going to the hospital. They say, oh, well, that's okay. But if you said, well, I heard this voice, and the voice said, be sure and go to Dr. Terwilliger at 10 o'clock in the morning and don't get an MRI because that's going to be bad for your wife. But when the doc says that you should have this kind of treatment, that's going to be a good thing. We'd say that that person was a little strange, I think. But for some people, that would be the kind of relationship that was desired. When we read about Ramakrishna, we'll find that his relationship with God was of that nature. We would say that he's crazy. The Indians said, no, this person is a saint because he has a personal relationship with God. Now, what's going to be surprising to us when we get there is what God looks like to Ramakrishna. Because God doesn't look like some guy sitting in a cloud with a long white beard. Ramakrishna's God, for one thing, was a woman, which makes things very interesting. Okay? Your question, then we have to get out of here.
I just say that you're saying, oh, like the guy who was sent, like you were doing the example, like, oh, God told me this and stuff. That's how a lot of religions are made. Like Scientology,
that's right.
It was just a guy who wrote a book and enough people believed it that it became a religion.
Well, do you remember, as far as I can tell, Jesus used to have a lot of conversations with God, and they were two-way conversations.
Yeah, or like Mormonism,